All right. Okay, thanks. Thanks to Kevin and Tim for the invitation to come and speak today. What I'm going to do is basically, my research to date really has focused on refugees and asylum seekers in the UK context, and thinking about the relationship between asylum groups, refugees and cities in particular. So I've looked at work around urban sanctuary movements. I've done work on spaces of care, such as drop-in environments. And I've looked at kind of the production of histories of hospitality, the way that cities attempt to sort of situate themselves as welcoming spaces or benevolent presences within the politics of refugees. Today I want to introduce a project that I'm currently working on called, handily enough, Producing Urban Asylum. And it's a 3-year project that I'm just about to sort of start the fieldwork on. So this is kind of an introduction to some of the ideas behind it and some of the sort of preliminary thinking, I suppose, before I get into the field. And it focuses on the experience of asylum in 4 UK cities, Birmingham, Cardiff, Glasgow and Sunderland. I like to go to the really exotic parts of the world in my research. It's one of the great advantages of doing research on asylum generally. So this project really explores the way in which UK cities have imagined their relationship to asylum as a political issue through a variety of kind of discourses, policy frames, local authorities, but also through the views and experiences of asylum seekers themselves and the publics that they come into contact with. So in this presentation then I want to do a couple of things. I want to give a bit of context to the project, give a bit of context to the UK asylum process so that we have a kind of common ground, I suppose. I want to outline some of the ways in which this work might connect with different ideas of urban imaginaries as well. So I'm going to think about the links, as I see them, between work on forced migration and cities. And in my view, the kind of lack of some of those links, really, and the way in which this project is hoping to think about those connections and articulate some new ones. And so, in essence, this project asks what challenges and possibilities are raised if we begin to take the city seriously when we actually discuss the politics of forced migration. So I guess I'm kind of on the hinterland between this kind of urban cultures, urban aspirations, ideas, and different forms of geographical debate. So to give a bit of context to this project and the wider kind of work that I'm situating this in, since 1999 there was an Immigration and Asylum Act in the UK that set up a policy to relocate asylum seekers from the southeast of England to a series of what are termed dispersal zones within urban centres across the north and midlands of England, Wales and Scotland. And this was an attempt to reduce what was perceived to be a burden upon London. And this word burden is used quite openly in sort of policy languages. At the same time, what was termed the National Asylum Support Service, or NAS, was established to administer this process and to provide kind of coordinated support to asylum seekers. So at this time, around 2000, local authorities entered into contracts with the central government, with the Home Office, to house asylum seekers. So they sought accommodation from hard-to-let social housing. And as a result then, we started to see, over the last decade, a kind of the emergence of localised concentrations of asylum seekers in a number of British cities. So this is a relatively kind of recent innovation, I suppose. Skipping ahead through that time period, to 2009, because it's probably one of the most interesting kind of recent innovations, is that there's been a round of contract negotiations for accommodation, moving away from purely local authority housing. So this round opened up this process to a range of private accommodation providers and companies. And so we're shifting away from public provision and urban authorities. So the Home Office established what was termed the Commercial and Operational Managers Procuring Asylum Support Services, nice title, or alternatively known as COMPASS. I think the UK government, like most governments, like to name things on the basis of what an acronym they can kind of produce out of it. So COMPASS was the effect of this. And this was basically a project to negotiate housing contracts through 2011. And it also took place at the time of a massive austerity drive within the UK government. So COMPASS was a target of significant funding cuts, and seeking to quote the Immigration Minister at the time, drive down the cost of asylum support under demands from the Treasury. So we saw these contracts around housing and urban authorities being negotiated at a time of cuts. So in December of 2011, the outcome of this process was announced, And surprisingly, the Home Office unveiled three private service companies who could dramatically undercut local authority provision as their preferred bidders. These are G4S, Serco and Reliance. Now you might know G4S in terms of quite high profile issues around the security for the Olympics. That's probably what they're most well known for. Also in 2011, they were voted the world's third most evil company, which is quite, you know, it's pretty good going. Only Shell and BP seem to be more evil than G4S. So the contracts agreed last for a 5-year period, and whilst their value is not publicly known, it's not been announced, estimates suggest that the value is in the region of £620 million. And opponents of these moves have quite rightly highlighted not only the profits that these companies are making out of asylum, effectively turning asylum into an industry, but also the number of high-profile cases of abuse, and most recently a high-profile death within existing contracts that companies like G4S and Serco have for deportations. These are also the companies that run detention centres in the UK for failed asylum seekers. So you've got these same companies basically in charge of the deportation process, the detention process, and now the accommodation process. Whilst the effects of dispersal accommodation being transferred to these private companies are still emerging, it's fair to suggest that with these moves, the power relations of asylum provision are being remade and remoulded. Urban authorities are increasingly having to renegotiate their position to the Home Office and to the kind of border agencies on the basis of this. And this poses significant questions of the role of cities as places of asylum, whilst also reflecting the kinds of claims that we've seen in a whole series of kind of recent urban studies around the privatisation of urban governance, the emergence of what are termed post-democratic cities, and this idea that key areas of public provision are subject to market forces and being placed sort of beyond the remit of public deliberation and political contestation. Now we can debate about how realistic those ideas are, but I think that we can see some of the connections in this move. So the contemporary kind of context of dispersal is notable for this patchwork of provision, privatisation, protest and support. And this produces a highly uneven and shifting geography of asylum in the UK context. Experiences and understandings of asylum differ markedly across this, depending on dispersal location, history, demographics, and local politics. Each of the cities that I focus on in this work, Birmingham, Cardiff, Glasgow, and Sunderland, have all experienced differing levels of dispersal across the time period, across the last decade. They've also taken different steps to respond to these contracts and these groups. And they also have differing histories of asylum activism, support, protest, and so on. And so what I'm hoping to look at, I suppose, in this work is the distinctions and nuances of each city's response, to develop a picture of the diverse ways in which this changing policy landscape, also these changing experiences, are being negotiated. So to briefly kind of talk about what I'm going to do, this whole multi-method kind of different approaches, looking at archival media research, interviews with a whole variety of different affected figures, even, in refugee sectors and so on, and also looking at the stories and narratives of asylum seekers themselves. And the idea really is to develop a picture of how narratives and imaginaries of asylum are produced and circulate within and between cities as well. So how cities can kind of engage with what their neighbours are doing. And the project takes the view that to understand asylum, there's a need to understand how abstract discussions over dispersals, over numbers, over bogus claimants, welfare applications, all these kind of ideas that get circulated at a national level, actually influence and are shaped by the histories, geographies, and interactions of those cities that actually accommodate asylum seekers. But what I want to kind of, I guess, talk about in the remainder of this time is why this might matter. This is a question that troubles me as I go to bed at night. And there are a number of reasons. I mean, hopefully there are lots of reasons why I think this matters. But I want to highlight two to you. Firstly, I think it matters from a very practical perspective. The majority of asylum seekers accommodated in the UK are located in urban environments. Therefore, there's a need to understand the relationships between these individuals and the cities they're located in. To date, though, examinations of the dispersal system and its presentation in policy have discussed this as a very coherent system, a process of population management, regulation, and the urban context here is largely erased. effectively what we see is arbitrary nature of decisions over dispersal. People don't have a choice about where they're placed. So we get a policy frame which suggests that it makes little difference if you're located in Birmingham, Cardiff, Sunderland or Bristol. And so you have a highly centralised spatial imagery. And it views dispersal as a kind of undifferentiated process, where urban kind of context, local history, doesn't really matter anymore. It's just about you get put on a bus somewhere. And secondly, I think it matters because the ways in which contemporary discussions of forced migration have actually looked at the city and framed it kind of reproduce this managerial vision of the urban. So we look at a whole variety of debates within forced migration, geographies of refugees and asylum. There are two sort of central images of the city that emerge most readily here. The first of these presents the city as a space wherein urban refugees are located, accommodated, or seek livelihood in precarious conditions. From examinations of urban marginality through dispersal in Europe, through to work on the internalisation of the border in US cities, the role of the city here becomes that of a container for individuals whose lives are placed on hold by classification processes, attempts to manage migration, distinguish between different types of migrant. Across these debates, then, the city is discussed as a kind of known, contained, governable space, somewhere where you can house undesirable elements or impose governmental authority. The second image of the city is kind of, in a way, a sort of parallel to this first one. And that's of the city as a site of potential sanctuary, of welcome or hospitality. So we've got a whole kind of lineage of work, I guess, looking at Europe, Canada, the US, Latin America, as urban projects of often temporary and conditional sanctuary, from the UK City of Sanctuary movement I've done work on previously, through to things like UNHCR's Cities of Solidarity Network. These are all examples of trying to consider cities as spaces for sanctuary approaches. But these two kind of views of the city, as a space of objection or as a space of sanctuary, rely, I think, on quite a common image, that of a bounded, contained object over which sovereign decisions hold sway, and into which strangers may be placed, moved, positioned, either through objection on the one hand or kind of apparent benevolence on the other. Thinking of the city in this manner as constituted in response to or reliant upon the discursive framings of the state and attempts to manage migration undermines, I think, some of the alternative ways that we might explore acts and imaginaries in the city. And I think Daniel's paper earlier talked a little bit about some of those different acts and imaginaries. Not only does this kind of account overlook the specificities of lived experiences, but it positions cities as repositories for national aspirations and desires. In the UK, we can see this about the idea of having an asylum system that's firm but fair, that's managed. And this finds expression through the city as a tool to actually make that kind of management happen. So this isn't to deny the state as a really important actor in the lives of asylum seekers. Of course, the state is essential here. But it is to suggest that in studying urban asylum, there's a need to actually begin to think from the city, to consider how the whole rich heritage of work on urban democracy, social justice and so on might be brought into conversation with forced migration in a way that doesn't just reiterate statist assumptions of looking at how conditional hospitality is defined and managed. One political orientation of this project is therefore to examine how different cities may be battlegrounds for asylum seekers and activists to actually articulate political projects that deny these kind of aspirations of sorting, management, and orderly accommodation. And so I want to kind of briefly conclude. Has that been there for long? So I want to briefly conclude, I guess, by talking about an example of this. So last month in the UK, there was a range of asylum seeker-led days of action. And I think the fact that these days are asylum seeker-led by self-organised groups, again, speaks back to kind of Daniel's discussion of these migrant activists. And these aim to highlight the situation of destitute asylum seekers held in seven UK cities. These involve marches. This is the march in Manchester, and protests to raise awareness around an estimated population of 8,000 asylum seekers who are destitute in the UK at present.
And this day of action called on the government to change its policy. So this was implemented under the new Labour government from the late 90s onwards, where asylum seeker support is withdrawn after a decision has been taken, regardless of whether an individual can be returned to their common country of origin. As some countries do not have deportation arrangements with the UK and therefore refuse to accept returnees, this places refused asylum seekers in a legal limbo between official refusal of status and the inability to return to the country they fled. But there are two kind of notable elements of these processes that I want to highlight. The first of these is that cities are positioned within these protests as authorities who have the power to adopt a critical stance towards government policy in the name of their inhabitants, rather than in the name of those worthy of recognition by the state. So this has been productive in a number of ways. In the last year, there's been a focus on opposing the production of destitution on city streets in Glasgow, where the City Council passed a resolution to condemn government policy on forcing asylum seekers into destitution. And it was also taken up by similar kind of authorities in Bristol and Sheffield. And the aim here is to effect change through building a critical mass of cities as critics of government policy. In part, this argument is compelling because in many ways it's urban authorities that are seeing the effects of destitution. And in part, it's compelling because it's the urban communities that are being fractured by this invidious choice between destitution or deportation. Whilst actions such as this might be minor events within national debates, they're focused upon challenging cities to act politically in the name of their inhabitants, be they British citizens or refused asylum seekers, makes some interesting examples of how cities can be politically positioned beyond this hospitable, inhospitable binary. Secondly, then, these protests, I think, attempted to reject an image of the city as a repository of state imageries of asylum, not only through this opposition to destitution, but also in a rejection of quite a dominant narrative in the UK context, at least, of contribution. So this day of action took place exactly a week after the UK's National Refugee Week. And that Refugee Week is an event designed to celebrate the contributions that asylum seekers and refugees make to the UK. The organisers of this day, however, were comprised, as I've mentioned, of self-organised groups of asylum seekers and activists. And they wanted to distance themselves from this... they wanted to distance their event, I guess, from this language of contribution, fearing its potential to reduce asylum to an economic commodity. Instead, they sought to challenge a concern with refugees that extended only those able to contribute to the city or the nation. So, for me, I think the significance of this challenge is how it speaks to a different account of the city as a space of forced migration. Focusing on the rights and needs of inhabitants of the city, regardless of status or contribution, not only repositions ideas of the marginal or sanctuary city, but it reflects some of the complex, informal, and unfinished elements of urban life, of how cities evolve, change, and adapt as newcomers arrive and others leave. This framing of the city is therefore centred on valuing those who inhabit the city, those who actually kind of make urban space. And so I guess a kind of conceptual connection would be to Magnusson's framing of seeing like a city, a political ontology that implies multiple histories and authorities vying for attention, histories being remade and remade as the city is itself becoming something new. What we might take from this view of the city as a site of incomplete political authority, then, is a vision of how cities are formed through collaborations, through the coming together of diverse interests and opinions. It's these collaborations, rather than prescribed contributions, that this form of urban protest sought to enable, promote, and valorise, I think. Okay, so in this relatively brief kind of opening, I guess, to this project, I've tried to introduce some of the kind of key ideas and the key context in which this might work. While still in development, then, this work seeks to critique the tendency to both under-theorise and, in a way, under-appreciate, I think, the politics of the city and work on forced migration. As a result, different ways of thinking urban asylum risk being unexplored and assumptions of worthiness are reinstated. By contrast, examining the specificities of urban context, of localised histories, of interconnected and interurban partnerships of everyday experiences of dispersal might present a different set of urban imaginaries and a different series of aspirations of what cities might become for asylum seekers. One opening here might be to think of the urban and the asylum through an image of collaboration. For it's in collaboration that contemporary cities are made and remade, as much through the investments, experiences and journeys of those seeking asylum as through any other inhabitants. Taking seriously such collaborations implies politics of critique towards narratives of refugee contribution, fixed histories of national hospitality, and policies that produce the destitution of many asylum seekers. Such a politics might start, I think, with the critical potential of starting to see like a city. Thanks.